and support, you can go online to bbc.co.uk/actionline or call the Radio 4 Action Line to hear recorded information on 0800 044 044. Lines are open for 24 hours and are free from most landlines. Some networks and mobile operators will charge.
BBC Radio 4's epic drama series set 100 years ago to the day.
Why should women who work hard take care of their families, who make extraordinary contributions to this country's good, why should they be denied a voice?
Come on, your husband.
Denied a vote.
This week, Harriet Walter stars as the suffragette leader, Emmeline Pankhurst.
Look what Mrs. Pankhurst has done to your wife's mind.
No doubt it'll wear off.
Homefront, part of World War One on the BBC, Monday to Friday at midday.
Now on Radio 4 Longwave and DAB Digital Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by the Reverend Peter Whittaker. Here on FM, Damian Lewis reads from Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, the new biography of the great American playwright by the theatre critic John Lahr. In today's episode, Williams embraces his sexuality and work begins on his erotically charged play, A Streetcar Named Desire.
Just before the new year, Williams moved back to the French Quarter of New Orleans. For the first time in his life, he found himself settled down with someone. The muscular, volatile Amado Pancho Rodriguez y Gonzalez, whose tall Mexican good looks gave Williams the mistaken first impression that Pancho was a bullfighter rather than a receptionist at the Ponchartrain apartment hotel in New Orleans. Williams' own transition from timid virgin to florid gay man was his defining struggle. He had grown up in a hothouse of thwarted desire. His mother, Edwina, was an expert at replacing carnal arousal with spiritual arousal, a sort of psychic jujitsu in which sacrifice became passion. He wrote,
"I had begun to associate the sensual with the impure, an error that tortured me during and after pubescence."
For Williams, the embrace of the sensual world was hard won. He described his youthful self as the little Puritan. And except for his one hapless heterosexual coupling at the University of Iowa, he remained celibate until the age of 27. When he finally had his first homosexual experience, Williams wrote in his notebook,
"I had the experience Saturday night which confused and upset me and left me with a feeling of spiritual nausea."
Eventually, Williams found release in male pickups and a life of profligacy. He had liberated his desire, only to be lumbered by appetite.
"I ache with desires that never are quite satisfied. This promiscuity is appalling, really."
Now his promiscuity dissipated in favor of a relationship with Pancho Rodriguez. A man-child of 25, Pancho was sensual, explosive, jealous, unlettered, and primitive. Pancho's frequent and fantastic misdoings filled Williams' life with sensational melodrama. At the end of 1946, Williams began to rework a play provisionally entitled The Poker Night. To his surprise, the characters seemed to flow powerfully onto the page. In the first draft scenes, with muscular, terse dialogue undecorated by the fine filigree of his lyricism, Williams set out the lineaments of need in each of his main characters. There was Blanche's hysteria over the loss of both the family home and the husband who
loved me with everything but one part of his body.
Then there was her baby sister Stella's bed sweetness with her virile, uncouth husband, Ralph. In these notional scenes, sex and survival were already the stakes of play. Ralph, whose name Williams instructed to be changed to Stanley when the first draft was typed up, was a mutant breed, a primitive. In the simple situation, desperate visiting sister intrudes on sensual paradise of sibling, Williams dramatized desire and put psychology into behavior. In Blanche's airs and graces, her ablutions, her romantic persiflage, her insistence on illusion, the hysterics masquerade was incarnated.
The soft people have got to shimmer and glow. Put a paper lantern over the light.
She used her wound as lure. She made a spectacle of the broken connection between herself and her own desires. By contrast, Stanley was comfortable in his skin. He was clear about his needs and about how to satisfy them. As Williams pored over the rewrite, he turned Stanley and Stella's railroad flat into a battleground that externalized his own internal war. Pancho's capricious intrusiveness, the lunatic sense of his own collapse, the bouts of sexual pleasure, the memory of the deadly family home, all these warring personal issues became the pigments that brought Williams' characters to life. When she gets off the streetcar, Blanche is literally and figuratively at the end of the line. She believes that her words have inadvertently caused the suicide of her beloved husband.
It was because, on the dance floor, unable to stop myself, I'd suddenly said, "I saw. I know. You disgust me."
Blanche is haunted by the unforgivable outburst at her homosexual husband, who rushes from her and blows his brains out. But the play traps another unconscious wish, to find someone to kill her. In the brutish Stanley, Blanche recognizes a death dealer.
"The first time I laid eyes on him, I thought to myself, that man is my executioner. That man will destroy me."
On the day he completed the poker night, March 16th, 1947, Williams wrote in his diary,
"It looks like P and I may have reached the hour of parting. He has been increasingly temperamental. I still care for him, but right now I hunger for peace."
He sent the play off to Audrey Wood. Wood's response was immediate and passionate. Her only quibble was with the play's title, which to her ear smacked of a Western action novel. Williams suggested the more poetic and tantalizing A Streetcar Named Desire. To the Broadway establishment's consternation, Wood persuaded the untried but well-connected producer Irene Selznick to take on the production. And once Williams saw Elia Kazan's production of Arthur Miller's All My Sons, he wanted Kazan, and only Kazan, to direct. Selznick rushed the script to Kazan, but the 38-year-old director didn't rush to read it.
"I wasn't sure Williams and I were the same kind of theater animal."
Williams was shy, standoffish, and fragile. Kazan, on the other hand, was brash, extroverted, and powerful. Williams was discombobulated. Kazan was a fixer. Although their temperaments dramatically differed, both Williams and Kazan wanted to change the shape of American theater. As a director of actors, Kazan had an almost symphonic ability to draw out and to orchestrate the tones and textures of his cast. That summer, trying to cast the part of Stanley, a new name was wired to Selznick in Beverly Hills: Marlon Brando. Brando, who was 23 years old, had appeared without much critical attention in 5 Broadway plays. He was a beautiful, brooding specimen, mercurial, rebellious, and rampant. Like Stanley, he was a ruthless man-child with reservoirs of tenderness and violence. Brando's acting style was the performing equivalent of jazz. The notes were there, but Brando played them in a way that was uniquely personal to him. In his ability to call out of dialogue a heightened sense of emotional truth, the freedom of his stage behavior was mesmerizing and revolutionary. Brando was a shot in the dark, and Williams needed convincing. Kazan called Williams, gave Brando $20, and sent him up to Tennessee's Provincetown home to read. Kazan recalled,
"That's all I said. I waited. No return call. After 3 days, I called Tennessee and asked him what he'd thought of the actor I'd sent him. What actor, he asked. No one had showed up, so I figured I'd lost $20 and began to look elsewhere.
Brando, who was broke, had decided to hitchhike with his girlfriend to Provincetown. When he finally arrived around dusk in the last week of August, Brando walked into a scene of domestic cataclysm, according to Williams. The kitchen floor was flooded, the toilets were blocked, and the light fuse had blown. To Williams, Brando was a spectacle of both beauty and prowess.
He was just about the best-looking young man I've ever seen.
Brando fixed the lights, then unblocked the pipes.
You'd think he had spent his entire antecedent life repairing drains.
An hour later, Brando finally got around to reading. He sat in the corner of the clapboard house with Margot Jones and Williams, who cued him as Blanche. According to Williams, Brando read the script aloud just as he played it. Letting Williams' words take him where they would and exuding the freedom of this approach, Brando was only 10 minutes into his audition when Jones bolted from her chair with a whoop of delight. "Get Kazan on the phone. This is the greatest reading I've ever heard," she shouted. To Williams, Brando was godsend. But for Pancho and Williams, the rest of the summer was clamorous. Williams sensed trouble brewing. He wrote to Wood.
"He is not a calm person. He is too capricious and excitable for New York, especially when I have a play in rehearsal."
Pancho was sent packing, and Williams returned to work on rewrites prior to the beginning of rehearsals. In the ending of the final version of the play, Stanley kneels at the feet of Stella, who holds their child on the stairway and sobs as his fingers open her blouse. "Now, now, love," Stanley coos. "Now, love." The scene demonstrates the couple's preserving lie. In Streetcar, Stanley and Stella collude about his rape of Blanche. For the Kowalski family to continue, Blanche must be sacrificed. In Williams' story, Pancho also had to be sacrificed so Williams' life, his work, which was his baby, could go on. Kazan said,
"If Tennessee was Blanche, Pancho was Stanley. Wasn't he attracted to the Stanleys of the world? Sailors, rough trade, danger itself? Yes. And Wilder. Violence in that boy, always on a trigger edge, attracted Williams at the very time it frightened him."
Williams wrote to his publisher, James Laughlin, on December 4th, 1947.
"Streetcar opened last night to tumultuous approval, packed house and with a slow warm-up for first act and comments like, 'Well, of course, it isn't a play. The second act, it's in three now,' sent the audience zowing to mad heights, and the final one left them and me wilted, gasping, weak, befoozled, drained, and then an uproar of applause which went on and on."
Gore Vidal wrote, "In 1947, when Marlon Brando appeared on stage in a torn, sweaty t-shirt, there was an earthquake. Stanley Kowalski changed the concept of sex in America. Before him, no male was considered erotic. A man was essentially a suit. He wasn't a body." In May 1948, Williams won the Pulitzer Prize for Streetcar. In October, Margot Jones's production of Summer and Smoke arrived on Broadway. After it was rumbled by most of the critics, Williams gave the failure the royal brush off. He threw a catered bad notice party, to which he invited
"the critics who gave us the two worst notices. The party was really swell."
At one point in the evening, Williams stole away to ride with Marlon Brando on his new motorcycle. Here, at the zenith of the century's promise, in the time of their defining triumph, the greatest actor and the greatest playwright of their era sped around Manhattan, feeling the exhilarating surge of power underneath them. Williams had embraced his sexuality and his talent. Now he was embracing his new momentum.
"I enjoyed the ride, clamping his buttocks between my knees as we flew across the East River and along the River Drive with the cold wind whistling and a moon."
Damian Lewis was reading from Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh by John Lahr. Trevor White was the voice of Tennessee Williams and Aaliyah Kazan, and Elaine Claxton was the voice of Blanche DeBar. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer, Elizabeth Allard.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. Lively discussions.
I'm beginning to wonder if you're safe to be let loose.
I don't know what you mean.
Diverse topics.
Right, that's it. Spades. Everyone ready? Spades up. Spades up. Off we go.
Penetrating questions.
Were you out on a limb professionally investigating something somewhat heretical at that time?
And simple ones.
We haven't got much time. What's the most important thing you haven't said?
Weekday mornings at 9, including In Our Time on Thursdays. From this week, here on BBC Radio 4.
Thanks for listening.